You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hello again. I'm Andy Borowitz sitting in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. By most economic metrics, from a 12% unemployment rate to a $20 billion budget shortfall, state of California is in a shambles. Our ongoing series, The Big Picture, continues today with a look at the politics of the Golden State. We're joined now by Dan Walters, a political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, and by Kathleen Decker, state politics editor and writer for the Los Angeles Times. And I'm pleased that our little series here brings both of them to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello there.
Well, let's just start right in. Dan, as I mentioned just a minute ago, the economic picture in California is looking bleak. And I know it's kind of a cliche, but why would anyone exactly want to take the reins of the state government right now?
That's questionable. In fact, I wrote a column once saying anybody who runs for governor of California ought to be required to undergo a psychiatric examination because, demonstrably, the state very likely is ungovernable, at least in the conventional sense of the word, as Arnold Schwarzenegger found out in his 7-year governorship.
It has been called ungovernable. Why is that the case?
I think it's ungovernable in the macro sense, because this is an extremely complicated state with uncountable numbers of ethnic and economic and geographic and cultural subgroups. So every issue produces multiple stakeholders, and the structure of the government is such that anybody who's not pleased by the proposed policy can stop anything from happening. It's been demonstrated many times. And so basically you have to have unanimity among a collection of stakeholders on an issue that in no way can ever become unanimously agreed on anything. And that's been true on water, on transportation, on education, and certainly on the state budget.
Kathleen, the state has been hit really hard, disproportionately hard, by home foreclosures. And unemployment in some rural areas is over 20%. Is your assessment, will this election really be about those numbers? Is it going to turn mainly on the economy?
Certainly that's been the dominant issue to this point in time, and there's no reason to think that it won't. I mean, for isolated numbers of voters on both sides, there will be other issues that activate them, just as there always are. But it's hard to overestimate the impact of foreclosures, unemployment, and just plain fear, I think, on the part of people who remain in their homes and remain with jobs on this election. It's been the dominant issue. It's the one that everybody's talking about when you talk to voters, and certainly the candidates are reflecting that in their advertising and in their speeches.
Well, so it's a big economic election, but is this just a reflection of what's going on in the country in general, or are there problems particular to California? I mean, I know that when I lived in California, there was already a tax revolt, and that seems to in some ways have presaged the kind of Tea Party stuff going around elsewhere. Does California express these economic frustrations more? In a more visceral, more exaggerated way than the rest of the country, or is it just kind of like the rest of the country?
I'm not sure you could argue this year that it's expressed it more viscerally, since there seem to be visceral things going on everywhere in the country this year. And in fact, the candidates here who most expressed the sort of Tea Party sentiment didn't win in the Senate or the governor race. So that's a tough thing to argue, but certainly this is a state that always has sort of an emphasis on economic issues and abhorrence of taxes, and also it's a state where voters don't typically pay attention to the lovely intricacies of the budget, and so you get situations where essentially, like at the federal level, people want all the services they've gotten used to having, and they don't necessarily want to pay for them, and you have, as Dan said, a disconnect with the state government that's set up so that a small number of people can throw a wrench into the works, and there's it's built into a system that presumes that there will be unanimity, but there's no unanimity on anything here.
Dan, speaking of the budget, there is no state budget, is there? Isn't it something like 80? Have you checked today? Is there one today? Is it
no,
something?
There's no state budget. We're now in record territory. There's never been a later budget than the one that's still undone in California.
How late is it?
Well, it was to take effect on July the 1. Actually, the Constitution says it should have been passed by June 15th, so if you pick your date. But it's at least that long. It's at least basically 3 months late. And nobody knows when it's going to happen. In fact, I tend to think it may not happen until after Election Day because so many of the measures on the ballot this year relate to the budget, including one that would change the voting requirement for passing a budget in the state legislature. And the fact that we don't know who the next governor is going to be. I mean, there's a lot of unsettled issues in California's politics. So the contending forces, in a way, have a motive to hold out and see what the landscape is after November the 2nd.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm talking to Dan Walters, a political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, and Kathleen Decker, state politics editor and writer for the Los Angeles Times. Now, Dan, up there in Sacramento, they haven't really worked out the budget yet, but I do note that they spent some very important time debating the future of the state rock in California. There was a question.
My favorite subject. Yeah.
No, there was a question of whether I knew that we had state birds. I didn't know that California had a state rock, but apparently the state rock of California is serpentine, and some people are opposed to that because the rock actually contains asbestos. Let's forget about the budget for a moment. Have we resolved the serpentine issue? Has that been put to rest?
The legislation that would have removed serpentine as the state rock died a ignominious death in the legislature in the final throes of its session.
Well, then I guess we can say we've made progress on one issue up there. So
well,
that's
no, it'll be back next year.
It'll be back, okay.
the forces of change, the forces of change in state rockism are regrouping themselves for a new assault on the serpentine.
Well, that's something we can all look forward to. Now, let's both of you guys, let's talk about some of the personalities involved in these contests. On the Democratic side, you've got two very established figures in state politics. You have former Governor Jerry Brown, who's back, and I guess he never really left.
I think the proper term is he's back.
and we have also Senator Barbara Boxer, of course, who's long-time senator out there. They've both been major forces in California for decades. And then on the Republican side, you have Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina, and they're both relative newcomers. Dan, why have these two races shaped up so similarly, where you have the vets versus the newbies?
Well, it's something in the water of California that we always can't manage to develop some new wrinkle in politics as nobody's ever seen before. In this case, having two women who were CEOs of major corporations running for statewide office in California against, as you say, two rather veteran entrenched politicians. It just seemed to work out that way. I don't think there was anybody who designed it other than running for office in California is an extraordinarily expensive business. And so Republicans who don't have an awful lot of fundraising capability in this state look for candidates who are, as the saying goes, self-financed, and that's been true of Meg Whitman. She's put over $100 million in her campaign and is just warming up. Carly Fiorina is not as wealthy, but she's put a substantial amount of money into her own campaign, and that's not an inconsiderable thing in this state because it's a very, very expensive place in which to run for office.
Kathleen, I want to ask you, how have President Obama's policy victories played out in California? There is a bill, I think, on Governor Schwarzenegger's desk that would go further than the current federal health care reform package requires. What's been the feeling about that out in California?
Well, Dan could probably speak better to what's on the governor's mind than I could here from Los Angeles. But certainly President Obama remains much more popular in California than he is nationally. We've seen the same sort of slump in popularity and favorability that we've seen in the country as a whole. But he started off from a much higher perch here. And so while he's slumped, he's still arguably the most popular politician in the state. And so his he does continue to have some sway. He's not faced it. We're not seeing Democrats running away from him to the extent that we're seeing that in some of the other states.
But that his popularity out there has it not translated to Barbara Boxer terribly well, or
it's hard to know whether she would be better or worse off. She has a record in all of her races. She starts off not terribly popular as incumbent politicians go. There's a blizzard of stories about how she's not above 50%. The reality is she's hardly ever been above 50%. And she has proceeded in the past to sort of scrap herself over the finish line with increasing success. She's knocked off Republicans with higher vote margins in every race. We don't know what's going to happen this year, and certainly this is seen widely as her stiffest challenge to this point. But it's impossible, I think, in this environment to sort of pull apart the strings. This election in California has been utterly dominated by money. As Dan mentioned, Meg Whitman's got $119 million in. She's thrown a blizzard of ads at the television screens of Californians and on the radio and in the mailboxes since the spring, since February. There's sort of the national factors coming in. There's the fact that California is a dominantly Democratic state, and so Democrats start off here higher than they do in other states. And so it's a little difficult to ascertain sort of where the Obama impact is on Boxer and where the sort of just natural swing of things is with voters looking at incumbents in general and her in specific in California and saying, time for a change.
Dan, I have to ask, is there a potential for a major realignment of the state this year? California's congressional district looks pretty gerrymandered. How many races in California for the House are really competitive this year?
Well, we have 53 congressional seats, which is the largest delegation any state has ever had in the history of the nation. But there's going to be very little change, if any, in fact. And since the districts are redrawn in 2001 in what might charitably call the bipartisan gerrymander, there's only one seat has changed partisan hands out of 53 in the subsequent 02, 04, 06, and 08, over eight elections. So there have been over 200 congressional elections in the state, and one seat has turned over in that time. And the chances are this year that you won't see much happen either because of those gerrymandered districts. The one person who did turn over a seat, Jerry McNerney, is getting a fairly stiff challenge, and he's sweating a little bit. And there's another Democrat in Southern California, Loretta Sanchez, who's got a little race on her hands. And oddly enough, a Republican in the Sacramento area, Dan Lundgren, is sweating it a little bit. And a couple of the guys in the San Joaquin Valley who are Blue Dog Democrats, Dennis Cardoza and Jim Costa, are a little bit worried because if there's a real fallout effect, it's probably going to be seen in the McNerney, Costa, and Cardoza seats. But, chances are that when all the dust is settled, all the incumbents will have been reelected. But it's an outside shot that one or two may go down.
I've been speaking with California's races for governor and senator with Kathleen Decker, state politics editor and writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee on this week's edition of The Big Picture. Thank you both for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Save the date. Join Leonard Lopate and food writer Mark Bittman on Monday, November 22nd at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum for an evening of food and wine sampling and culinary conversation. You can buy tickets at the events page at WNYC.org. Up next, New York Times columnist Gail Collins looks at some of the strange things that politicians across the country have said over the past week, from my favorite, Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, to Jerry Brown in California. And later on, Michael Blanding describes how Coca-Cola has become a global brand and what the costs of that success have been, from environmental hazards to possible deals with paramilitary organizations. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC receives support from Roundabout Theatre Company's production of Mrs. Warren's Profession by George Bernard Shaw, directed by Doug Hughes and starring Cherry Jones and Sally Hawkins. Tickets are available at roundabouttheatre.org. Discover Mandarin. One-on-one Chinese lessons online with teachers live from Beijing. Customized tutoring for students and professionals ranging from beginner to advanced learners. More information available at discovermandarin.com.
WNYC is giving away a limited number of tickets to The Screwtape Letters, a play adapted from the C.S. Lewis book, Thursday, September 30th at 8 at Westside Theater. Enter to win. Click on free stuff at WNYC.org.
So you're the new student that Dr. Frankenstein sent over. Let's get started with today's lesson. This is bread.
Bread. Good.
And this is WNYC.org/support. Where you find out how to become a WNYC sustaining member.
Good.
It is good, and it's the easiest and most efficient way to support WNYC. Now it's time to turn on commercial radio.
No good.
I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's been another exciting and slightly absurd week on the campaign trail. So New York Times columnist Gail Collins joins us, as she will every Tuesday up until the November election, for our ongoing series, How Did Politics in America Get So Weird? Gail, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, you had a good week this week, I guess.
Oh, no week is a bad week during this campaign, I swear. You know?
Well, we're going to start this week, I guess, with really my favorite person on the planet, Delaware Republican
Senate nominee. I knew you were going to say Christine O'Donnell.
Christine O'Donnell. Well, she's, you know, given my line of work, you know, as a political satirist, Christine O'Donnell is, you know, just like a gift. She's just the gift that keeps on giving. Now, a number of things she said in the past have surfaced. She's had an illustrious career on MTV and other places. Let's just take a listen for a moment to what Ms. O'Donnell had to say about the issue of witchcraft while appearing on Bill Maher's show, Politically Incorrect, in 1999.
You were a witch.
I dabbled into witchcraft. I never joined a coven.
Wait
but
a minute.
I did.
You were
I
a
did.
Witch?
Yeah, she was.
I was a witch.
I mean, wait a minute.
That's exactly why.
How are you to be a witch?
Because I dabbled into witchcraft. I hung around people who were doing these things.
Having fun?
I'm not making this stuff up. I know what they told me they do.
Well, what they do?
I mean, one of my first dates with the witch was on a satanic altar, and I didn't know it. And, I mean, there's little blood and stuff like that.
That was a date?
Your first date was a satanic altar?
Yeah, we went to a movie and then, like, had a little midnight picnic.
Let's have a movie and a sacrifice?
Well, you know, I think we always remember our first date as a witch. Don't you, Gail? First of all, I think in the interest of full disclosure, have you ever dabbled in witchcraft?
Remember all the fun we had on the satanic altar.
On the satanic altar. Well, now, you wrote about Salem witch trials, didn't you?
I did in one of my books. The Port Salem witches were really done in.
I should mention the book is America's Women, 400 Years of Dolls, Drudges, Helpmates, and Heroines. Maybe,
good subtitle work there.
Absolutely. maybe we need to do a new edition where we introduce Christine O'Donnell to the pantheon of American women. What did you make of that comment? Or that, I guess that's an archival footage of
Christine. Well, she's obviously has been in the past. Besides being a witch at some point in the past, she also clearly was at a long period there. Just one of those people who will go on, say anything to be on television, and who will just go on television and just jabber away.
By the way, I take that very personally. That, as a member of that class of people, I really am a little offended by that. But yeah, she really, when she was on with Bill Maher, she just really she ran her mouth quite a bit.
And now, of course, the Wiccans are very upset.
Are they?
You do have this, you know, I don't know how many voters are members of the Wiccan religion, but there's a bunch of them out there, and they're feeling very dissed. So.
When you lose the Wiccans, you've lost America. they have a lot of fundraising power. Okay, now, I want to play this. This is, in the short time since her comments on Politically Incorrect have come to light, She, of course, has given a response, and let's see if we can listen to that clip of what she had to say.
I was in high school. Who didn't have interesting friends in high school?
So she is clearly throwing her high school friends under the bus at this point.
Who didn't date on a satanic altar in
high
school?
We all have. Yep, we all have. Now, seriously, though, I know it's hard to use that adverb.
This is very hard. Yeah.
Let's take it seriously. This is, you know, America's women, 400 years of dolls, drudges, helpmates, and heroines. Do you think it's fair that we're, it's certainly fun that we're digging up these old clips? Is it fair that we're doing it? And
oh, it's really fair. I mean, okay. This is one of the things that voters really want and need to know. I mean, not that you need to know whether she was on the altar with the witch, but is this person who's running, who you don't know much about, who's sort of new to the your vision, is she a crazy person or not? I mean, that's a very important question. And, this is what we're getting at here.
Right. Well, now she's also been attacked for comments she made on MTV in the 1990s about masturbation. Are you familiar with those comments?
I am, yeah. And that's sort of the interesting thing to that one to me, and what she said about masturbation is, I think, sort of basic. You know, I was raised Catholic, as she was, Catholic dogma. So it could well be there are a number of senators who believe that. It's just the fact that you don't bring it up normally. She may be the only person in the entire United States Senate, potentially, who you actually know what her position on masturbation is.
We see this is, I am actually a one-issue voter. That is my only issue. And I bet you can guess what side I'm on. But I felt very much under attack by her personally. All right, now we were talking a minute ago about the races in California, and Republican gubernatorial candidate Meg Whitman launched an ad campaign against Jerry Brown, which featured more archival footage. We're digging into the archives. It featured Bill Clinton attacking Brown in a 1992 Democratic presidential candidate debate, and so from the last century. And then Brown responded to the ad by attacking Bill Clinton and joking about Monica Lewinsky. Now, is this really an appropriate thing to be arguing about, you know, Monica Lewinsky and...
I don't know if it's appropriate, but in this race for Democrats, you do not go around attacking Bill Clinton. He's practically all you've got out there right now that everybody seems to like this year. So if you're a Democrat anyway, so you just don't go around messing with him. And you also do not go around. I think that Jerry Brown at one point, he called Meg Whitman's campaign Nazi-like in some way, shape or form.
Nazi-like.
Yeah.
And that's also that doesn't play well.
We got to stop doing the Nazi thing. I mean, we just absolutely totally have got to do no more Nazis. Nobody calls anybody a Nazi unless they actually have information that they're really a Nazi. Other than that, we can't go there. It's just getting crazy and it's very offensive.
Well, I don't know if this counts as crazy or offensive, but we have to close with this. There are reports that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid was at a fundraiser, and he referred to Kristen Gillibrand as the hottest member of the Senate. yes, no? Is there someone hotter than Harry Reid, I think?
Well, I think she is actually the hottest member. She was elected that by a magazine there. But he also referred to the Democratic candidate in Delaware as his pet. We cannot be doing that at all if we want to get anybody elected. Someone has to be elected from Delaware, really.
Well, I am Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lopate, and I've been speaking with New York Times columnist Gail Collins for How Did Politics in America Get So Weird?, our weekly series looking at the verbal gaffes and blunders that politicians have made. Thanks again, Gail.
A pleasure.